Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again to another edition of the Come Out of Her, My People show. I am your host, Mark Call, and as I suspect most regular listeners know by now, this is a show where we talk about exactly what that verse in Revelation 18:4 means, where it says, come out of her, my people, do not participate with her sins, so that, hopefully, prayerfully, we do not partake of the plagues. As I've said for a while, I think all of that is increasingly obvious, and given where we are, given how much has happened of late, how things are literally accelerating to the point where, honestly, I think those with eyes to see would be hard-pressed to deny exactly how far gone much of the world is, particularly the once-free United States and so forth. I want to take a little bit different look, I guess I would say, today at what's going on, and most importantly, of course, as always, what we need to do about it. Let's call this show Let's Talk Tactical, because one of the things I want to try to do is lay out some specifics, talk about a couple of options, some projections, some pretty good minds have been speculating, if you will, drawing conclusions and suggesting options for the kinds of things that may be happening. Now, as I go through this, I'm going to point out again, the overriding theme of this show has always been and continues to be, come out of her, so that we don't participate in the evil stuff and therefore do not partake of the plagues. And yet, as we do that, there are certainly a number of considerations along the way. One that I pointed out for a long time. Big Brother makes it as difficult as possible. Those minions of Satan who walk in men's shoes would just assume that nobody even knew that the option exists. That's why they lie about Scripture. They've lied about so many things that more and more people are waking up to. Indeed, we've inherited lies from our fathers, as the prophet Jeremiah told us, and he was correct many centuries ago. But what I want to do today, again, let's talk tactical, is emphasize up front, and yes, some of you may recognize this reflects my background, I guess, although I certainly heard this motto long before I ever took a job with the one of the three letter corporations biggest in the world that had to do with computers, IBM. Anyway, their corporate motto was think. I remember being back in grade school, and my one of my grade school teachers, back before they decided that proselytizing and dumbing down was more important than educating, thankfully. Anyway, had a great big plaque on her desk that said think, and that was what we were actually encouraged to do, as opposed to today. I'm going to encourage the listeners to do that too. We're going to lay out some options and some items and some things that are happening, all of which I encourage you to think about, obviously pray about, and let it be a guideline for some of the other things we'll talk about as we continue through the show today. So let me throw out a couple of items right up front. I'm not going to go recounting the evils again. I hope by now everybody is well aware of those, and an hour isn't long enough even to list them at this point. But what I do want to say up front is, let's just start here. What we're seeing clearly, no doubt about it, let's be honest, is satanic. Paul, in his letters, talks about how we are to, we're not warring against physical things, but against powers, principalities, the leaders of the darkness of this age. Lots of ways of translating it, but bottom line, we are in a spiritual battle. You've probably heard that before, and hopefully by now it's more than obvious. And clearly, the end, and I'll come back to this, our protection, the things that we have hope in, are all from him. And clearly, without that protection, we probably are, I guess the proper way to say it is, if you don't have his protection, you don't have a prayer. As we go through this, then, I'm going to lay out some options and some items and some factors, and I'll go into detail in one or two of these, but let's just start with some things that I think are increasingly clear. One, and I've mentioned this a lot of late, diesel. Kerosene, the refined petroleum products that run locomotives and jet engines and tractors and trucks and literally transport the food, plant the food, harvest the food, move the food. So much of all of that is under siege. the regime. And by that, I don't mean just the Biden puppet who isn't doing much of anything except following orders and putting his little X where he's told to. But ultimately, it's clear that there has been a war on the lifeblood of the global economy. And we're seeing diesel prices rapidly heading towards the $8 a gallon mark that some suggest is, well, and not just magical, but satanic. A lot of independent truckers, small firms, and so forth will be forced to shut down at that point. And then it becomes a snowballing problem where if the trucks don't move the fuel, then there's no fuel to move more fuel. And what we see is basically a large gridlock. So that's part of it. We certainly are also looking at increasing attempts to destroy the power grid. The regime has been very successful on that score, talking people into buying idiotic electric cars that turn out you can't really charge them very well. And if the hydroelectric system goes down and if the power grid goes down, they're going to find, oh, that's even worse than having to pay $10 for gasoline because I got no power at all, can't move. So there's that element. Another factor, obviously, food, famine, the destruction of the supply chain. I'm going to mention housing, and I'll come back to that in a second. All these things that are literally conspiring to destroy the middle class, and that's because the intent to destroy the middle class is now obvious. It was deliberate. We're seeing a move to disarm people, and I have said for a long time, the reason why that is at warp drive speed now is because they know that when people wake up to all these other factors, they're going to be downright hopping mad. And there are a lot of them. I'm not encouraging this, but certainly there are a lot of people that will say, I want to kill those SOBs that destroyed my life, killed my children, killed my family, ruined everything that I've been working for. You can imagine people being kind of upset about that. And my concern has been, if you go back and look at history, compare the French Revolution with the American Revolution. And in the case of the French, which was not based on self-evident truths and an understanding that the rights we have come from God, fraternity, you know, essentially it was a whole lot more liberated, more enlightened, and a hell of a lot less scriptural in orientation. And as a result, blood ran in the streets. Well, guess what, folks? We're probably a lot closer to a French Revolution in America this time around than an American independence-type revolution based on the principles of the Declaration. And finally, again, part of the reason for the move to make sure people are disarmed, we're seeing it. More and more people are awakening to poke remorse. Why, oh, why did I take the first Cyclone B shot? Or why was I stupid enough to take the second or the third or the fourth? And as people realize, look at the carnage among young people, then younger people, and then finally now children. And there's no excuse for this. This is not, as I've said, this is not just bad science. This isn't just people that are on the take, people that are hideously compromised. These are satanically evil people that know damned well, and I'll use that terminology, even if it's offensive because it's true, they know damned well that what they're doing is killing kids. And they're jonesing for it. These are the same types, the same mentality that are anxious to kill kids with abortion, pre-birth, post-birth, and after 6 months. It's all about a continuing, ultimately, a satanic agenda, and we're seeing all of this. So a lot of food for thought here. Where I'm going to suggest we head is, what does all this mean as certain things begin to play out? A case in point, I won't spend a lot of time on this. It's a long article from an excellent economist and a fellow with a pretty good head on his shoulders, David Stockman, Reagan-era budget advisor, writing for the International Man, and he has been talking about the meltdown for quite a while. And again, good background, good credentials, and a pretty good understanding. He writes in his latest missive that the Great Reckoning has begun. And like I said, I'll go through this rapidly. I encourage you, if you want to read the details and see the charts, you can pull it up online. But the 30-year mortgage rate, he said, could have been a wake-up call. It soared by a quarter point, 24 basis points recently, to over 6%, 6.18%. Now it's more than double the 2.65%. This is housing, folks, a rate which prevailed just 18 months ago. Pre-COVID pandemic, January 2021, it's the highest level since the tail end of the great financial crisis back in 2009. In a word, he says, the Fed's fake economy, based on ridiculously, obviously, unsustainable ultra-low interest rates, is coming to a thundering end. And it's doing so far more abruptly and violently than the Fed and its Wall Street megaphones ever even remotely imagined. As a result, housing affordability has gone into the tank. It's now the lowest point on record, back to the late 1980s. It would take a 30% drop in average home prices just to reverse the affordability plunge since the COVID pandemic. And he goes through chart after chart, comment after comment. Let me just hit a few of the highlights here. The surge in homeowners' costs during the last 6 months especially is truly startling. And without going through all the numbers, at an average $350,000 mortgage, median price, the monthly payment has gone up from $1,500 to over $2,100. That's a 40% increase in just 6 months. Can you say housing affordability collapse and ultimately real estate bubble collapse? The Fed is about to unleash the biggest housing crisis since the bursting of the bubble in 2007, he says. And what with all of these other things going on, bond yields at their highest since December, since 2015, the myth of low defaults, in other words, people that can't afford to pay for what they've got, is about to be monkey hammered. Papering over bad credits is now over. The jig is up. He quotes Stephanie Pomboy, who recently tweeted that, prepare to see an absolute onslaught of corporate defaults and downgrades. It's about to all implode spectacularly. He goes on to say that the Fed's mistakes, as indicated by a chart going back decades, have been systemic. It's not like this wasn't deliberate. As rates peaked lower and lower with each cycle, the financial bubbles got bigger and bigger and bigger. And at the same time that the bejesus was being inflated out of Wall Street, the planking was being laid for a new bout of goods and services inflation on Main Street, which takes us to the producer price index. All commodities PPI has hit a soaring red hot 21.5%. versus the prior year. And he goes on through all the other inflation numbers. You knew this. It's hard to ignore at this point. Inflation is out of control. And, of course, the idea was to do that anyway. And on top of that, let me throw this onto the mix. This is just another quick story from Zero Hedge, came out this afternoon. Millions of barrels from the U.S. Emergency Petroleum Reserve. So here's the point, folks. If the idea of the Petroleum Reserve, back when at least it wasn't completely counterintuitive and idiotic, was to try and say, oh, if there was ever, for example, a national emergency, like, say, no diesel fuel, and we really needed diesel fuel to fight a war or keep the economy from tanking and people from starving in the streets, well, we would have this reserve. So what's the Biden regime doing? Well, they're destroying the reserve, destroying the infrastructure, and now they have sent millions of barrels, no, not to Main Street, can you say, abroad, including communist China. Yeah, I guess if you're paying attention, that shouldn't surprise anybody. The rest of the story from David Stockman goes on to make the point. This is a whole new inflation ballgame, and what we're seeing here is the Fed and its license to print money has now been revealed as one of the great follies of all time. We have a double whammy of rising energy prices and wage costs. You've seen all of this. So the great reckoning, he says, has commenced, and the low cap rates of the last decade have reached their sell-by date. The great money bubble that has been fostered is now heading for the wall. So again, what we're seeing, and no surprise here, a lot of things that have been done deliberately, not only to destroy the infrastructure, bring about the famine, and guess what? If you were looking to do worse, you couldn't probably have planned it any better. The Biden regime this week was talking about cutting output and shutting down the Permian Basin in Texas, one of the biggest in the country. People say, well, could they possibly be that stupid? No. You can't deny it. This is deliberate. There was a couple of Supreme Court rulings that are kind of interesting, and basically the EPA, which has been destroying the economy using the bureaucratic hammer, was reined in, or at least that seems to have been the intent. The court basically has pointed out that the unelected bureaucracy that rules the country without oversight from voters or legislatures is, imagine this, unconstitutional. Now, they didn't go as far as your host would. There are all kinds of three-letter agencies, and if you read Article 1, you'd say, well, there's no authority for those. Why do they even exist? That's a darn good question. But what they're doing, of course, is growing in size, scope, and strength, and destroying the economy, taking on a life of their own. The beast has gone out of control. And once you see the problem, says this author of Jeffrey Tucker from the Epoch Times, of what the administrative, the regulatory state has done to destroy the economy, how the EPA has been used in so many ways. This ozone thing is just one of them. There are other agencies likewise, 432 of them. If you remember when I like to read the Declaration every year, he has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. That's precisely what these agencies are doing. The conclusion of these stories is literally, once you see it, you can't unsee it. And if people can't recognize that this needs to be reversed, well, the United States is not only dead and gone, stick a fork in it, but everything is lost. And on every front, I think that makes the point. All right, from there, I want to go to one other story. As you know, it's not enough to take the American people's guns, destroy their infrastructure, destroy their economy, destroy their future, inject them with poisons. No, no, we got to have World War III, too. And here's a piece that came out courtesy of Hal Turner, breaking news dated July the 6th. In just 6 days, now that would be 5 days at this point, the Nordstrom 1 pipeline. Now, this is part of the battle against Russia, and the idiocy, if you will, of trying to poke the bear and ultimately, I'll say it pretty bluntly here, piss off a nuclear-armed country. I think they've been jonesing to see if they can't get Russia to take a hit or hit out at us. But one of the things that they have done is they've announced, okay, we're going to shut off the Nord Stream 1 pipeline and cease all natural gas flow into Germany in 6 days. Now, again, 5 days. And by the time a lot of folks hear this over the weekend, it'll be less than that. A complete cutoff from Russian natural gas because Putin will no longer sell any vital commodities to unfriendly nations. Obviously, that would include Big Brother America, too. And without natural gas from Russia, understand the implications of this, folks. The German economy will simply stop. And when that happens, other European countries, of which Germany is the most powerful economy, which also get their natural gas from Nord Stream 1 and the pipeline, will also stop. About 2 weeks after the European economy stops, the U.S. economy will be forced to also slow down and stop, because all kinds of things ripple forth from that. Thanks to its own sanctions against Russia, shooting itself in the foot, reloading and refiring again, the West has reached the end. And as I look out and as I point out some of the lags and some of the things that on this show and others, we've been talking about literally for now months, if not a couple of years, but certainly the acceleration over the last months has been dramatic. This is the thing I'm leading up to. I encourage folks, again, think, understand all of the factors we're talking about here. The factors including the lag, things that take a while to ripple through and destroy the food supply, the energy supply, the ability to ship goods via rail and truck, and so forth. What's going on with housing? How all of this is going to affect people who, for example, can't afford to buy food anyway, but now we'll find that they can't afford to buy food. They can't afford to fill up the tank in their car. If they have an electric car, too bad. They won't be able to go anywhere anyway. And ultimately, they're going to have to decide, do I want to pay the mortgage or have a place to live or eat? It's going to get ugly. No wonder they want to be, Big Brother wants them disarmed. So as I talk about think, I'm encouraging this food for thought and preparation. How does all this look? What does it boil down to, and how does it play out? Well, with that in mind, and this is going to take us through the bottom of the hour break and through some other discussion and some speculation on the far side. I'm going to agree and disagree with some of the points in this piece. This has come from a fellow named Paul Fahrenheit at his Substack. And he seems to have a pretty good head on his shoulders. Again, there are some things I'll disagree with in here. But he makes some comments, some pretty cogent observations, and some speculations concerning what he thinks of, and I can't really argue, as the inevitable Second American Civil War. And that's what he titles his article and says, as this purposely provocative title states, the Second American Civil War will happen. And, for example, he just gives a number of them, and since we've talked about them, I'm not going to go through a lot of detail. The recent Supreme Court ruling on Roe v. Wade unleashed the full might of the, well, he uses a tiny bad word here, the mierda, if you understand Spanish, the caca de toro, lib media complex. The state has allowed casual violence on behalf of those who want to continue the wanton and absolute murder of children, pre-birth, post-birth, and of course with the poison poke. And that's only the most recent example. You can also look at other aspects of what's been going on. Like the January 6th counter-revolution. You know, they had their Bolshevik revolution, and they're not about to brook any return. So you have these bogus, idiotic hearings. And the day that the committee realized they had so much power and destiny, that will ring out from the throats of men on both sides of the war to come, suggests the author. Here, in other words, there is a narrative, and ne'er the twain shall meet. Why do I say this? Well, there have been two different mythologies that have spawned themselves from this charade. And he puts it kind of an interesting way. I don't completely agree, but I think to let him have his due is important here. The blue mythology, i.e. the leftist communist take, and notice even the red-blue lines, folks, those are backwards. I contend that the waste stream did that on purpose. Rather than calling the red states the communist states, which would have been consistent, they hid that, and they called them the blue states. And then the red states are the anti-communist. Oh, wait a minute. Right, the colors are stupid, but I'll use his color numbering anyway. The blue mythology, i.e. the communists, is that January 6th was proof that the evil patriots out there in flyover country, MAGA country, illegally stormed the Capitol, a sacred temple, right, to Dionysus of our democracy. All right, the red mythology is that January 6th was the last stand of patriots against a disgustingly corrupt and evil government. They wanted to make their dissatisfaction with that same evil government understood. And here's where I'll take an issue and say, nope. In fact, it wasn't the last stand. It wasn't even close to the last stand, folks. We're going to see that, and it's going to be ugly. But in fact, it was merely an impotent protest. We saw how impotent it was with how it fizzled and didn't turn into anything even remotely resembling either an honest petition for redress of grievances, much less an insurrection. And it was unarmed, and it was suppressed, and it's been twisted and spun ever since. But here's the thing that he says that I think is at least kind of fascinating. This will take us to the break. The place of Trump, the one that they love to hate and that the red states want to literally deify, and I have a problem with that, obviously. The place of Trump, though, is central in both of these mythologies. The recent testimony given by some bimbo turncoat on Trump's staff, there's a whole lot of those, is that had to do with fighting the Secret Service to join his people. Okay, all of that has now been revealed to be a great big whopping lie, but it solidified the mythology of the almighty Trump as the man and the only man, arguably, who can save America, at least in the minds of his supporters. On the flip sides, it solidified that he's literally Hitler 2.0 to his opponents. And I'll give him that. Trump, simply because he stood up to a lot of the evil that the deep state was doing. Not, by the way, all of it. Not even remotely all of it. I think he failed with the poison poke and with the warp speed. And I think he clearly failed by saying when it comes to unconstitutional red flag laws, hey, the hell with the rule of law and due process. Let's take the guns first. Worry about that later. That was a classic failure and probably the biggest, the one that if there is a historic judgment that will look negatively on him, it's that when push came to shove, he allowed himself to be shoved right into the ash bin of history, and the United States fell without a fight, rather than literally doing what it is that the left is accusing him of. If he had been the Donald Trump of legend and mythology, he would have, in fact, said, my supporters should rise up and take the country back now, because you know what? This cretin Obama is going to destroy it. Well, in hindsight, that's pretty obviously exactly what he intended to do, and indeed he has done. So, in any case, what the author here, Paul Fahrenheit, said is there is a lot more to this mythology than meets the eye, and it's more than most people will give credit to. And essentially, he says that the post 9/11 zeitgeist ended when Trump descended the elevator. He galvanized a lot of people. And now we're living through the era of Trump. And what Joe Biden has accomplished is to prove just how great the gap is and to further divide those who understand the rule of law, believe what this country once was, believed in self-evident truths, and those who are literally simply worshiping at the altar of Satan himself. And I wish it wasn't that clear. But maybe that's the good news. It is that clear, and it's that undeniable. And we're going to see this Civil War play out. Like it or not, we need to be thinking about it. And when we get back here, folks, after this bottom-of-the-hour break, we'll pick it up right there. Hate your next-door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. All right, welcome back, folks. Second half now of the Come Out of My People show. I am your host, Mark Call, and we're talking today about, well, tactical concerns, things that I'm encouraging people to think about. There's that old motto from IBM back when thinking was a good thing to do, as opposed to the kind of thing that is no longer being taught in the American cesspools, and people are literally being purged if they try it. But I want people to think about what's coming and what the implications are of some of the things that we've literally mentioned and outlined for months at this point that are now accelerating. And as we went to break, I was going through a piece by Paul Fahrenheit called The Second American Civil War. And he is outlining what he thinks probably will happen, how it might play out. And I'm gonna again suggest that we need to talk and think tactically about what all of these things mean. That does not mean, in other words, there are major overriding strategic considerations. Who do we serve? What kinds of things do we do? How do we come out of her? But as we get there, certainly it's important that we have things that we need: food, water, clothing, shelter, the ability to gather together and to continue to persevere, stand, having done all to stand, all that kind of stuff through what's coming. So it's important we think about and look at some of these options and even speculative looks at how what's coming may play out. So again, when we went to break, I was outlining his thoughts, and I want to make one other observation. I've mentioned this before, but when it comes to the idea of a civil war in America, and maybe whether it's inevitable or not, I will suggest that it's about the worst thing that I could possibly imagine. Well, with one exception, and that would be what happens to America, and we can see it from here, if we don't get that civil war. So it's an ugly option, and yet, folks, the uglier that option is, the more important it is to realize that the intent of those who serve Satan is something far, far worse, arguably worse even than death itself, a hell on earth. And we've seen it. The prophecies in the scripture bear that out. The mark of the beast, the things that they intend to do, the billions of people that they intend to kill. All right, so back to the story here. He basically said what's interesting about January 6th and the mythology, the blue versus red mythology, is how Trump, and whether he's demonized as the Hitler, and I can't believe, Trump derangement syndrome. Some of these people are truly off the wall. And it's funny how somebody can be so demonically obsessed with Trump and yet fail to notice that they've got a blithering idiot, a moron, a fellow who wears a diaper at both ends that is clearly senile and has no business anywhere close to the Oval Office or even not outside of a nursing home. And that constitutes a so-called president? Give me a break. And as for divisiveness, how much more divisive can it be than to have somebody who serves Satan in a land that once at least understood about self-evident truths? Okay, anyway, he said, there is more to this Trump division than people are giving credit for. And the zeitgeist after 9/11 ended when Trump descended, and this is the era of Trump. And he says, and I don't like this, but I'm going to read it anyway, that the Trump hole can only be filled by the man himself and the ideas that tie themselves to his name. And in fact, there is no right wing without Trump. He's more important even than his own personage. He's the means of summoning an ideal, a shift of epochs. And anyway, all of that aside, still, every issue in this country is coming simultaneously to a head. Now, I'll make one other observation since I don't agree with that last statement, but I will, because he believes that it's so important, I'll give him that due. That's the following. The Messiah does not come from Washington, D.C., folks. He doesn't come from New York City either. And those that are looking for a Messiah in the form of a political figure are woefully, indeed, deadly mistaken, cataclysmically mistaken. Still, though, the battle is coming to a head. Recently, we saw all of these things. I'll give him a quick list here. California leaked the names of every concealed carry license holder in the state. Congress and the Biden Fuhrer have now gone to confiscation with these so-called red flag laws. Absolutely an abomination. Not just a mere infringement, folks. They're an abomination to the very concept of private property, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, and about everything that this country was founded on. I'll say it again. You take the one piece of property, the singular item about which it was said shall not be infringed, and you steal it without so much as a how do you do or a an actual day in court? Oh yeah, we'll worry about stealing the guns first and due process later. That is as Soviet as it gets. And by the way, the Soviets used exactly that technique, as you know, to ship people off to the gulags. If you take their guns first, that gets a lot easier. Meanwhile, the office of the president, once seen as a, he says, holy position, set apart, has now been degraded into the moronic, senile, imbecilic clown-in-chief, the diaper-wearer marionette-in-chief, and that says nothing about the state of the federal government or the United States military, which, of course, has not only been dumbed down and poison-poked, but is literally becoming unable to fight its way out of a transgender box. There's been a fire burning, he adds, since the 1990s. Waco, Ruby Ridge, Clive and Bundy, Ted Kaczynski, Dr. Pierce, the Oklahoma City fake bombing, the federally instigated false flag. All of that discontent, though, was brought to an end by the, evil rapist president. But I'll give it to him. He may hate him, but he was competent. Unlike the Biden Fuhrer, Clinton was good at what he did, which was also evil, and that included his rapes. He was good at that. Look how effective he was at getting away with it. But he was able to ensure that the communist Chinese takeover proceeded apace and that the road to perdition was followed. The fire was reduced to embers. The tech boom in the early 2000s brought about the intellectual foundations for another go at a real American right-wing revival. Something was wrong. So many major pundits, including Glenn Beck, Michael Savage, even Rush Limbaugh, began questioning what could possibly have been wrong with a Barack Hussein Obama, who arguably wasn't fit to be president, didn't meet the constitutional requirements, the birth certificate was laughably fake, and yet, as far as the waste stream is concerned, you're not even allowed to talk about that. And still, all of that permeated the edge of consciousness and the internet. People were waking up to it. The fire was again stoked. They came to a head in 2015 when Trump came down that escalator, and he talks about other personages that were central to the revival. And while there was a fast track to all of this coming to a head, it was derailed by another federally instigated false flag at Charlottesville. And meanwhile, we have no center. Now, that's an interesting observation, too, when it comes to this next zeitgeist. And this is an important observation. It all sets up the battle lines to come here. This is where we're headed. Team Red, in other words, the communist American state, the deep state swamp cities, you name them, you know them, Detroit, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, the cesspools, all of these are meant to bring about the next age. And that would include even some of the neocons that are kind of hard to tell which team they're on. They may or may not be on Team Red. Oh, did I misspoke? Oh, see, there you go. Team Red. Team Red is the communist team. I still have difficulty with these colors. Anyway, he claims that the neocons are on Team Red, and I don't buy it. So it's easy to understand how, obviously there are some disagreements that I would have with some of these characterizations. Anyway, Team Blue. There you go. The leftists are the true reactionaries in the worst sense of the term. And that's why this war is inevitable. Not only, says the author, will we have this second American Civil War, but it'll be a second war between the states. Now, on this score, I'm going to let him, again, make his point. I might disagree a lot, and he is going to go at least in part to where I might have gone. Still, though, he says, I think I can accurately predict which battle lines will be where and what states will be on which side. Okay, so here we go. Those that are on the red side for sure, in other words, the constitutional side, the New South, if you will, Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Utah, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, in other words, a lot of flyover country here, Oklahoma, Texas, Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, North and South Carolina, Kentucky, West Virginia. How about the leftist, communist, Bolshevik side? Hawaii. The left coast, California, Oregon, Washington, along with Nevada, Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, not flyover states on both coasts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Now, this is an interesting category. Undecided, unsure, TBD. Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado. That's the place where your host is. Certainly there are lots of other listeners in those border states, those states that would have looked a little bit like Missouri maybe in the 1860s. Along with Wisconsin, Idaho, Indiana, Georgia, and Virginia. Virginia is an interesting battleground. Certainly that's true here in Colorado. I can speak a little bit to my understanding of Colorado politics. Out here in the hinterlands, folks, the far conservative areas, the agricultural areas of the state, well removed from the Denver-Boulder communist axis, along with Aspen, a lot of places along the Front Range. It's a whole different story, and I honestly believe, I think it's pretty clear, that the election rigging didn't just take place in the states that get the coverage, like Pennsylvania and so forth in the last election. I think Colorado was rigged. And as a good indicator of that, you have the congresswoman from Rifle, who actually represents the district that I am physically in, Southern Colorado. The gun-toting Lauren Boebert, who's probably one of the very best in the whole Congress. Well, she won overwhelmingly. They couldn't, in fact, flip that one. And that's another indicator of the fact that, no, these battle lines aren't going to be quite as clear as the author here is going to try to make them out. But I will go through it. The war won't be just urban versus rural, he suggests. And I think there's more of that than he's going to give credit to. But it'll be fought in all terrains, all climates, all regions of the country. Why? Because Team Red and Team Blue is the Occam's razor's way of understanding the things currently at play in the U.S. And Team Red includes everybody that's read the Constitution, that might have picked up a Bible, has any understanding of right and wrong and so forth. Team Blue includes the Mierda Libs, to Antifa, outright evil, to regime shills, and even some military loyalists. But here's where things kind of get interesting. This is the thought process that I encourage people to pay close attention to, think about, pray about, and see how this might play out as you make your plans and try to understand what could be coming. Blue cities in red states. Blue cities in red states. Okay, so for example, Texas, that would have been considered a red state. Look at Houston. Look at Austin, one of the leftist enclaves in a place like that. They'll get with the program, he says, very quickly. In the hinterlands, in the red states, constitutional areas, but in blue states, that would be what he is suggesting, like places where your host is, will do the same. And again, I disagree with that, even though the latter will have less reason to do so, especially if they share a border with another state, a red state. But regardless of how things shake out exactly, in the weeks and months between the crisis period, and I suggest we're there now, and the outright, obvious, undeniable war starting, the battle lines, at least initially, will be drawn on state borders, he believes. Why? Why does he emphasize state borders? Well, because of inertia. You know what that is? It's because they're there. It's because that there are existing governmental structures in these states. People are inherently lazy even when they're acting. And if the need for a new government arises, well, why should it be created out of nothing? Yeah, let it come from the same slime pit as before. And of course, here in Colorado, most of us would recognize Denver is about as slimy of a slime pit as you get. It's the closest thing in Colorado to a San Francisco or a Chicago or a New York, a true hell on earth kind of a place, and they've worked hard to make it so. But still, as the author says, you have a government with a constitution, a history, personnel and its employee, and if you factor in national guards and state police and so forth, military forces, it already exists. Now, on the other side of that coin, yeah, let's not forget, folks, there was an election that was rigged. There are all kinds of evils, and there are clearly elements of these state governments that are corrupt and illegitimate, even stolen. But still, says the author, state governments exist. And here's where I think the logic maybe breaks down, and I'll disagree in thought some. These state governments have begun to realize that they can gain power and support by opposing the federal government. Now, notice, this is not the case in the People's Republic of California, which is basically communist to the hilt. Same thing for Oregon and Washington. But in places like Colorado or New Mexico or Arizona, where we have maybe neocons or outright leftists in the governor's mansion, some at least in the state houses that still have some understanding, there are more battle lines, more division. But as the example he points out makes clear, hey, look at Florida. You've got some leftist enclaves like Miami, but still, DeSantis has led the charge. A lot of other governors like Stitt in Oklahoma have begun following his lead and opposing Big Brother's overreach. It's now as if state-centric sentiment is declining. In fact, he says, never before in my life have I seen so many Americans conscious of the state that they're from and in which they inhabit it. Now, on the other hand, he hasn't been to Colorado, I don't think, or to some of these other states that he puts on the border area, because there is a lot of sentiment here that says, you know, we don't want the state government in Denver imposing their gay, transgender, idiotic socialist agenda and their mask mandates and their poison pokes any more than we do the Biden regime, which is pretty much the same thing. Should the ruling elite continue to make the federal government into a comically tyrannical body and impose their agenda, and I think that's a given, vaccine mandates, election rigging, you know it, it's things we've been talking about, expect the red team state governments, i.e. the constitutionally oriented ones, to act in their best interest and oppose the central fascist federal government. And so far, so good. It's just that that is not true in those areas of the country that have a huge rural contingent that simply won't follow a communist state government. Recently, he says, I spoke to an army recruiter. Now, this is interesting, too, as it points to the coming battle lines. The army recruiter brought to my attention one of the most important pieces of news I've seen in the United States in a long time. Currently, he says, the army... That's the United States Army, once an entity charged with defending the nation, now charged with political correctness and, trying to foment World War III or who knows what they're doing. But one thing's for sure, it's not defending the borders. Anyway, the Army now has the lowest number of new recruits, ready for this, since 1973. Now, this stunned me, he said. So I looked at the Army's benefits, all the things they're offering new recruits. Sure enough, sign-on bonuses, enlistment bonuses have been increased from $30,000 to $50,000. Federal tuition aid has been up by $1,000. Now, what good is it to you to have a federal tuition and study, transgender underwater basket weaving or something like that? I can understand why some of this is falling on ears that are saying, come on, you're going to poison poke me? Why would I want to? I don't care how much money you give me. The GI Bill is beginning to be awarded even sooner, and similar things are happening with the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. So it's not just the military. It's the entire federal government that's having this problem. More and more people are retiring, moving to the private sector, or simply quitting. Outright satanic agencies like the FBI, CIA, ATF, etc., than ever before. Whether we're talking military or civilian, the vaccine mandate has culled manpower even further. In fact, 12% at least of military personnel are currently undergoing separation procedures or awaiting to see whether or not their religious or other exemptions are going to be improved. So far, they've been waiting without avail. And guess what, folks? That's 12% that know better. That's not including those that are dropping dead or taking planefuls of passengers, military personnel along with them, crashing in the California desert and so on. The catastrophic effects of the poison poke aren't just affecting manpower directly with people that are leaving. It's affecting manpower with people that are dying. Bottom line, FedGov is undergoing one of the greatest manpower shortages it's ever experienced. And guess what? Most of the people they're losing are competent white men, in the case of the civilian side. In the military, they are disproportionately senior NCOs, non-coms, and junior officers like E6, staff sergeants, E9, sergeant majors, and second lieutenants and O3s and captains, people like that. So for military, for readers that are non-military minded, senior NCOs and junior officers are, functionally anyway, the most important part of the Army. They're the backbone. They execute the actual missions thought up by the higher-ups. This line caught my eye. This will, in essence, mean that the military will have too many brains. Oops, I got to put sick after that, right? Some wonder whether they have any. And not enough limbs. And remember what the Obama regime did on its way out. They literally purged the flag-ranked officers to get rid of all of those that wouldn't pledge allegiance to, not the Constitution, mind you, but to the Obama Meister himself. Looking at the state of the military, he says, I don't blame people for leaving. You had the humiliation in Afghanistan. That was particularly striking. I watched the faces of the men of the 82nd Airborne change in real time. They were humiliated with the disaster there. And, of course, we have the vaccine mandates. But the Army's been toxic ever since the Obama regime purged an entire generation of officers and NCOs. And literally, it's been downhill ever since. We lost in Iraq. We lost in Syria, although we were never officially really there. We lost in Afghanistan. We're losing in Ukraine. No fixes are coming. And what they do may do, though, is get their war. My high school history teacher, he said, once made a point of telling me that no matter which society you're looking at, when you have a large number of unemployed men of military age, bad things follow. I can't tell you where these orphan soldiers and agents will end up, but it will lead nowhere good. Now, I'll suggest one other thing. This is more food for thought. Some of them will no doubt fight to break the beast that killed their careers and perhaps their lives or their health. And they've lost their health. They may not be that good at fighting. But if they've lost some friends and loved ones, they may, in fact, be really motivated. Depending on where this war pops off, the man says, I expect casualties possibly breaking 100 million. Now, if you remember Deagle Report, folks, they're suggesting numbers twice that over the next few years. And let's go through the numbers quickly. We've only got a few minutes left. The current population of the United States, urban population, is just shy of 275 million. And the supermajority of that's concentrated in a half dozen cities on both coasts. You know that. We've talked about it. He goes in to describe the next bioweapon, the typhoid cholera outbreaks. I will suggest that because of the destruction of immune systems, that's more than likely. We haven't even talked about the fighting, but that's not where I want to go. I want to just end up with a couple of items that I think are really important to understand here. One of the elements to me that strikes me has to do with the potential for sieges. If you imagine how a red-blue war would break out, the obvious thing to do would be to surround, just like in the biblical times, and lay siege on Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. New York would be a particularly easy case, right? It's surrounded by water, cut off a few bridges, and it's cut off, with the exception of the major airports. And he points out, look at the interstate highway. It was built during the Eisenhower administration to serve as military infrastructure, urban fortifications. Notice how all these things have been dug. You've got mortar emplacements, ammo dumps, strike areas, staging areas for motor pools, i.e. rest stops. And have you noticed how there is a loop around the major cities? Mostly the international airports are inside it. So all of this lays at least some of the groundwork for what a potential siege war might look like. I'll point out one last thing in the minute or two that we have left, and that is one of the concerns that I've had out in the boondocks is that if I had to suggest, and I like the book Teotihuacan by James Wesley Rawls as a good scenario too, how things might play out after a huge breakdown in society, one of my concerns has been what I call the criminal rape gangs. literally laying siege, destroying the inner cities. Denver is a good example. L.A., the gangs loot, murder, rape, and pillage their way out. In the process, they get all kinds of great guns and vehicles, and they hone their military skills and organization. They move, and they generally would move out through the interstates. Why? Because that's the easy path. There'll be gas stations and things to raid along the way. What that means is that people outside those cities probably have a few weeks or months to watch and prepare. On the other hand, if there is a siege mentality that breaks out, like this author is suggesting, and I can see it, what that means is that those cities may be bottled up. Now, they may have air traffic coming in and out. They may even have air superiority with their military for those that decide to stay and don't succumb to the poison poke. But what it does mean is that the battle lines are going to be a lot more interesting than many of us have probably thought through. And we haven't even talked yet about Russia and China and whether they will enter the war. Again, lots and lots of things to think about. I encourage people, think tactically, but understand that really this still remains a strategic battle. We must come out first. But as we're doing it, it's very helpful if we can plan and look ahead, pray about, think about some of the things we can already see coming, how that's going to look, what various tactics of both enemies might look like, and how it is we want to make sure that we're not really on either team, but we do know who we serve. And that's Yod-Heh Vav-Heh and Him alone. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.